Exploration with Dr. Mishu Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and then bring on our special guest today. Our lead story today concerns the weather. Well, as Mark Twain once said, everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it. But the weather seems to be going berserk. We're talking about massive flooding on a historic scale up and down the Mississippi River all the way down to New Orleans. And then tornadoes, monster tornadoes on a historic scale. You've seen the pictures of the devastation one after another. Tornadoes ripping the guts out of major towns in the heartland of America. Not to mention drought at the same time in the American Southwest. What is happening with the weather? Well, we'll say a few things about that in Exploration, and then we're going to move on to radiation. Cell phones, are they really that dangerous? The World Health Organization has put out a notice saying that, well, it's not conclusive, we're not positive, but people should exercise caution with regards to cell phone and its effect on cancers. And there's no doubt that ionizing radiation, especially the radiation emitted from reactors, is dangerous, can cause cancers. And we'll give you a sum up of what's happening with the Fukushima plant and also the situation around the world. Germany set off shockwaves the other day when the government there decided to close down all other nuclear power plants by 2022. This is now sending a tremendous wave of anxiety in the nuclear industry. Switzerland has now followed suit, saying that it will also phase out its entire nuclear fleet. And what's going to happen to France and other nations that are heavily dependent on nuclear energy? And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're going to bring on Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's written a book, a rather controversial book, called The Flooded Earth. And he's talking about biblical flooding of the earth, not just topical flooding, given the fact that the earth is heating up. And also, I'd like to thank all those people that participated in my book tour. I went through a 10-city book tour going through Boston, New York, Washington, Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, talking about my latest book, Physics of the Future. And it's because of you, the listener, that the book sailed on to the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, for an entire month, it was in the top 10 of all books, all nonfiction books sold in the U.S. of A. So I'd like to thank you all who participated in the book tour, purchasing a copy of the book, and also we are using the book as a premium to raise funds for various public and community radio stations that carry Exploration. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The big story today is the weather. What is happening with the weather? We're talking about flooding not seen for decades along the Mississippi River. You've seen the pictures all the way down to New Orleans. In fact, the Army Corps of Engineers is taking emergency measures, actually releasing water, flooding other areas in order to save New Orleans. And then we have tornadoes, monster tornadoes, tornadoes that are ripping the guts right out of America's heartland. And it sounds like, well, it sounds like something out of a Hollywood movie. And yet it's happening every night on the evening news. What's behind it? Well, there are many theories. Let's talk about a few of them. First of all, we have local fluctuations in the weather, and then we have more long-term effects. Local fluctuations in the weather, for example, include La Niña. La Niña is a cold spell off the west coast of the United States and Latin America, And some people say that La Niña is causing the jet stream to be altered. So let me explain, first of all, why it rains and what drives the weather over much of the United States. First of all, it was Benjamin Franklin. That's right, Benjamin Franklin, over 200 years ago, who figured out why it rains. It rains when cold air meets hot air. Hot air contains lots of moisture in vaporized form. However, it doesn't rain because it's too warm. When warm air laden with moisture hits cold air reduces the temperature of the warm air. The warm air can no longer keep water vapor in vaporous form and droplets form. Rain droplets form, and that's why it rains. Well, why does it rain over the United States of America? First, we have the jet stream coming in from Canada, bringing cold Arctic air over most of the United States. And then we have moist, warm air coming from the Gulf of Mexico, laden with tremendous amounts of moisture. Well, we have two things going on right now. First, we have La Niña in the Pacific, which is directing the jet stream over much of the United States in a rather irregular way. And then we have the fact that the warm air from the Gulf of Mexico is warmer by 1 or 2 degrees on average than normal. And the combination of the two, the combination of basically more cold air coming in from the Arctic and Canada, hitting warmer air laden with moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, causes an enormous amount of moisture to condense over the United States. And that, in turn, is one of the reasons why the Mississippi River is so swollen. In fact, it's swollen on a level not seen for decades. Now, as I mentioned, we have local fluctuations and more historic cycles of the weather. La Niña is a local fluctuation. It comes and goes on a scale of, let's say, 3 to 5 years, but the kind of flooding that we've seen here is historic, and so local fluctuations just don't cut it. Other people are saying that, well, it's a combination of the longer-term effects, that is, global warming. Global warming, some people think, is heating on average the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, which means that more moisture is evaporating from the Gulf of Mexico, and that moisture has to go somewhere, and when it collides with a jet stream, that's where you have the thunderstorms, the flooding, and the tornadoes. Take a map of the United States of America, and then draw the jet stream, which comes in from Alaska and Canada, sweeps down through the Midwest, and then goes up to Maine. And then draw the Gulf of Mexico with all that moisture hitting the Gulf Stream, and you realize that the collision of the two creates a corridor. That corridor is where precisely you're getting all the tornadoes. People call it Tornado Alley, for example. And that's precisely why much of the Mississippi River area is being flooded. It is the collision of the cold air and the warm air creating a corridor along the United States where most of the flooding and the tornadoes take place. Well, the excess moisture explains the flooding, but what about the tornadoes? Well, it turns out that tornadoes are byproducts of thunderstorms. The larger the number of thunderstorms, on average, the larger the number of tornadoes that you get as a consequence. Now, let me make one thing clear. There's no smoking gun in the sense that you can't say, aha, this is one factor driving everything. However, what's happening with the weather is consistent with global warming. Now, global warming is not necessarily a uniform warming of the Earth. It is global swings. So instead of calling it global warming, you should call it global swings. When you add excess energy to the atmosphere, the energy has to go someplace. And just like water in a bucket, when you swing it back and forth, it doesn't uniformly rise. It rises on one side, drops on the other. That's why you can have massive flooding in one area and droughts, like in the American Southwest, in another area simultaneously. And if you look at the swings of the weather, just not in the United States, which occupies only a tiny fraction of the Earth, but globally, you begin to realize that we're talking about larger and larger swings in the weather. Now, again, there's no one smoking gun. You have short-term fluctuations and long-term cycles. What I'm saying here is that what's happening is consistent with global warming, and if it's true, it means we're going to have more bad weather in the future. Not consistently. Sometimes we'll have great weather, but other times we'll have more massive swings simply because there's more moisture and there's more energy fluctuating around the planet Earth, circulating around the Earth, creating flooding in one area and droughts in another area. Also, the controversy about radiation and cell phones are heating up. The World Health Organization, a rather conservative body, came out with a tentative warning. It doesn't say, aha, cell phones cause cancer. It doesn't say that at all. It simply looked at the large number of studies that have been done on cell phones and cancer. Now, to be fair, most of the studies show no effect whatsoever, or effects that are so small it's within error bars. However, there is something there, they say. That is, the larger number of exposure you have to cell phones, the larger the number of cancers, brain tumors, for example, that you might get, even though the number is extremely small. So this is a cautionary note. It does not mean you should throw away your cell phone. In fact, if you use only your cell phone once in a while, it's not a big deal. However, if you use the cell phone extensively, then a word to the wise. Even though for the most part the effect is minuscule, it's barely on the radar screen, in fact, if you are indeed worried, then you may want to go to the store and buy an extra extension so that you don't put the cell phone right next to your ear. So what's the solution to the problem? More studies have to be done. We're talking about a very small effect. Cell phones do not release ionizing radiation. They release non-ionizing radiation. Now, ionizing radiation comes from, let's say, X-rays and gamma rays, which are known to create cancer. In fact, Madame Curie, one of the founders of the field of radioactivity, died because of radiation poisoning. Radiation will, in fact, cause serious health effects, including cancer. But cell phones emit basically non-ionizing radiation, radiation that is too weak to rip apart the atom, and as a consequence, these effects are very small. Well, let's now talk about Fukushima and its effects, where we definitely have ionizing radiation coming out on a large scale. First of all, the repercussions are enormous. The Europeans are getting jittery. The Germans simply said no more nuclear power. Of course, it still has to go to the German parliament, but Chancellor Merkel has said that she's going to reverse her long-standing policy of supporting nuclear energy and saying we're going to throw in the towel and we're going to phase out all, not just 17, but all nuclear power plants in Germany. Germany, in turn, gets about 25% of its electricity from nuclear, and so it's going to have to rely much more on energy efficiency and other forms of generating power. Switzerland, not to be left behind, joined in and said that it too would begin the process of phasing out nuclear energy. France went the other way. France gets about 80% of its energy, its electrical energy, from nuclear, mainly because of its connection with the Force de Frappe. The Force de Frappe is France's independent nuclear deterrent, and that's one reason why France is so heavily dependent upon nuclear, because of its close connection to the weapons industry. And we should also mention that President Barack Obama is also at a turning point. Decisions have to be made in the next year, which are going to affect the fortunes of nuclear energy for a decade. Now, realize, first of all, that it takes about 10 years to build a nuclear power plant, to go through all the licensing and finally bring it to fruition and generate electricity. But costs have also ballooned. The cost of a nuclear power plant is upwards of $5 billion. And Wall Street is rather skittish about this because it means a huge investment, and we don't know what the political and economic climate is going to be 10 years from now. In fact, many people look at solar. The fact that solar prices are dropping slowly while fossil fuel prices on average are rising, they point out that the two curves could intersect in about 10 years' time, meaning that solar energy could be every bit as competitive in the marketplace, toe-to-toe, head-to-head with fossil fuels because of the gradual dropping in the price of solar energy. And that's another reason why Wall Street is rather skittish about nuclear energy. Why make a massive investment in nuclear energy when solar becomes attractive 10 years from now? We should also point out that the situation in Fukushima is still very unstable. First of all, the government has now officially admitted that it's not going to stabilize the reactor this year. It may take sometimes next year before they finally hit the bottom and they can finally get the pumps working so they can relieve the workers who are manually putting water into these damaged reactors. And so the situation there is not stable at all. Also, how long will it take for a cleanup? One nuclear engineer said maybe 100 years. Now, where did that number come from? First of all, it took 14 years to clean up Three Mile Island. It took 25 years to clean up Chernobyl, and that operation is still in progress. And here we have three reactors that we now know probably went through 100% core melt. If you have a TV camera and you go down there and photograph the cores, what do they look like? If they look like what happened at Three Mile Island, then the core basically collapsed, pulverized into tiny little pieces, and so it looks like, quote, a bowl of granola. That's what a nuclear engineer told me who was in charge of the cleanup operation at Three Mile Island. So we basically have three bowls of granola, collapsed cores at Fukushima in various states of melting. And as a consequence, they're going to have to cut it up with hacksaws. Once they get in there with TV cameras, know the geometry of the core, they're going to have to go in with hacksaws, hacksaw the core apart, and then take out the pieces one by one. Well, you can imagine that's a nightmare. It's going to take years, decades to do this, and there are three reactors in various states of melting. And so some people say that it's reasonable to assume that it may go way beyond 30 years, which is what the Hitachi Corporation has estimated, and go on to perhaps 100 years for the cleanup operation, costing perhaps tens of billions of dollars that Japan simply does not have. And also, with regards to health, the situation there is so bad that children are going to be exposed to 20 times the amount of radiation that an atomic worker would normally get. I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is rather disturbing and is hitting the bookshelves this week. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, on exploration, of course, we've had programs about global warming. We've talked about the effect on population and on agriculture and on tropical diseases. But here's a book that talks specifically about how our cities, some of our major cities, will go underwater or may have to be abandoned because of global warming. The book is controversial. However, it gives you a frame of reference as to what scientists are thinking if sea levels continue to rise, not 1 foot, 2 foot, but 5, 6, 7, 8 feet above normal. What happens to our great cities? What about warfare between nations when national borders begin to collapse because of mass migrations of hundreds of millions of people? Something to think about. Once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth.
Much more fun project. I've been in Rare Earth with Don Brownlee. I'd rather do astrobiology.
Oh, but well, I actually interviewed you, either you or Brownlee, I forgot.
Yeah, you did. And it just seems to be a happier topic to me to put my head in the sand, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do that much more.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, well, the engineer gave us the go-ahead, so let's start with the first question. Oh, the first question that we always ask our guests is, how did you, as a youth now, get interested in science? So I'll lead off with that question. So, dig back to the cobwebs and think about what it was as a child that set you off in the direction of science. Okay, so the engineer said we're going to start in 10 seconds with that first question about you as a youth. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and Earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, what steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton, and so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons, but that got me going.
Okay, and that set you off, and how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground. But it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space, and especially how other Earth could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology, and in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes. And up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for an ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off. But what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. When you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect, but over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if, based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, just from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice, and I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you can think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. Salt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong, and we project 50 years into the future?
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down, obviously, all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, that completes the first part of our interview with Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, you may also want to pick up a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, it was among the top 10 books, the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the United States of America. And it was the number one science book in this country, Physics of the Future. Get a copy. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Peter Ward of the University of Washington at Seattle, author of an explosive new book hitting the stands right now, even as we speak. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So what would it be like in a world where we lose Venice, we lose Miami, we lose Bangladesh, we lose the Mekong Delta? What happens when perhaps nuclear weapons are used to prevent mass migrations, which will inevitably happen as entire nations become flooded and realize that 50% or so of the world's population lives next to the ocean, many of them in megacities? What happens when some of them go underwater? So once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Think about it, and then ask yourself a question. How far are you from the ocean, and what is your height above sea level? Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I'm really breaking my heart is trying to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the dock. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coastal cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet, and which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise, and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back, but Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will. And the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think 30% of their land area is already under sea level. And they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year. Dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When the global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3-foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction, and lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there. And believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the Bay cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities? Historic cities such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay, and what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And if any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is endangered. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay, and well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level. Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like, and are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan, if not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point for, or I'm sorry, a small level sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York, and not off the top of my head. I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay, and let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the rivers behind yourself, these big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance, snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains, and these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone, the coastline changing. What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There'll be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced, they weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission prediction. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay. Now, let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you are going all the way back to a time called the Eocene. And the Eocene was a very interesting time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago, mm-hmm. but we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now. Mm-hmm. And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes, but at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Uh-huh, 10-foot rise in sea level. So the ice caps, they disappeared 150,000 years ago?
Well, we have very little fossil record of what an ice cap shape looked like because mm-hmm. it's floating ice. It doesn't leave any record of itself in sedimentary rock. But we have pretty good evidence on if there's an ice sheet because of the scratches and striations that moving ice produces. You can date some of these surfaces and get an idea about the direction of the ice and even in many cases the thickness of the ice depending on how deep the grooves were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good sense of when there was ice and when there wasn't.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about mass migrations and how that could affect world politics. We've had Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network on our show, and Peter Schwartz is a consultant for the United States Pentagon. And the Pentagon asked the Global Business Network a very simple question. What does global warming mean for the military? What kinds of military conflicts could arise because of global warming? And they looked at the maximum case, and the maximum case shows that you could have mass migrations of not just a million, but tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people. Look at the situation in Bangladesh, for example. And at that point, national borders could begin to crumble. How do you stop 10 million people from crawling all over your national borders? And what will nations do at that point? At that point, according to the Global Business Network, nations may reach for nuclear weapons to preserve the integrity of their national borders. And they specifically looked at certain hotspots where we have two opposing nuclear powers, and then the question of what happens when borders disintegrate. So what do you think?
Well, the unfortunate thing, I never knew about the Peter Schwartz report, but 2 years ago when I started writing this book, I actually put a 5-page scenario of exactly that, of Bangladesh really collapsing under not just the fact that much of it was being inundated by salt water, but once again, it's that pesky lateral movement. It's not just that they won't have a place to live, it's that the crops fail. I mean, Bangladesh feeds itself now, but barely. But they're projected to have a gigantic population rise. At the same time, they're going to lose this 3-crop rotation per year. And so my scenario certainly sees Bangladeshis pushing into India and India pushing back militarily. Actually, I got this scenario not from the Pentagon, but the CIA several years ago did the very similar sort of assessment. And they, I think, quite presciently said, yes, sea level rise is going to cause migration of borders. One aspect of it that you may not think about right off the bat is sea level rise is going to affect not only coastal cities and coastal agriculture, but much of the transportation corridors on land occur right near or at sea level. Transportation lines, major highways, lots and lots of rail lines, these things will go out very quickly because of storm surge. So when you're talking about mass migration now, if we're the case where sea level is producing mass migration, we're probably in a world where the normal transportation infrastructure has been highly degraded, let's put it that way.
And what about megacities? If you take a look at population rise, it's not uniform across the world. More and more peasants are leaving the farms, going into these gigantic megacities, creating gigantic megaslums, and of course they're next to the water. So what happens when they get flooded? Where are they going to go? We're talking about hundreds of millions of people potentially being pushed out of their new home. What's going to happen then?
Well, because most megacities are surrounded in one case or another by at least small to large farmlands. I mean, it's, traditionally it was the case where you had the city, you had the farms surrounding it. Agricultural land will be inundated with humans, and this just exacerbates the problem of feeding ourselves. We're really looking at a case where, look, the elephant in the room is just too many people on this planet. It's just at this stage we have to deal with the idea that the human population can continue to do as it's doing unimpeded. Whatever happened to zero population growth, that movement in the 70s that said slow down, that has disappeared entirely, and that is the single most important part of the equation.
Okay, now that we've painted a picture of what our children, our grandkids, and our great-great-grandkids may face, then the question is, well, what are they going to say when they look back at us? What did we do to prevent this disaster from happening? So do you have any positive thoughts about what could be done, or is it inevitable?
No, actually, there's quite a bit of hope. Look, let's go back 5 years. Global warming was certainly a topic, but I would bet that you would have a hard time finding a single person on the planet now who hasn't heard in one language or another those two words strung together and have a sense of the implications. There has been an enormous amount of work to get the information out. I have to take a shot at journalists because journalism now is really based on this idea that you have a pro and a con, that every story has to have the negative side. And what makes me laugh is I can imagine somebody now doing an interview about gravity, and here's Isaac Newton, and the anti-gravity side says this. We really have to continue the sense that the word has to get out. And what I find most hopeful is I teach college kids, their generation gets it, their generation is worried, and their generation is doing things about it. And that's my sense of it, that we are going to get a hold of this thing, that we're going to find better and more alternative energy sources. We have to get off the coal habit. They keep saying we're addicted to oil, but the addiction to coal is way worse, way, way worse. And that coal is the cheapest form of energy on our planet, and it is, in a sense, centuries' worth is there. It's not like peak oil. Peak coal is centuries away.
Now, the Chinese are building one coal plant per week. Every week, a new coal plant is created in China. And to be fair, they're also creating solar panels as well. But what's going to replace coal, even if we reduce our dependency on oil, even though we go electric? Electric cars get their electricity from coal. So electric cars, in some sense, make it worse because they get their energy from coal. So what's going to replace coal?
Well, hopefully we have many things. There's not going to be any one single thing. And we're going to have to, again, I hold my nose, embrace nuclear. We're going to have to hope and pray that the experiments taking place in Berkeley in the labs there for fusion reactors work. I mean, if we can harness fusion power, boy, we're in great shape. But I think what we're going to have to find are enormous changes in lifestyle. Let's take one. We really need to erase airplane travel the way it is now. Airplanes are horrible polluters. You know, what's wrong with airships, lighter-than-air airships? What's wrong with staying home for vacation? And we scientists, we're among the worst. You know, we flip from place to place, from conference to conference. What about nice old sailing ships? you know, I bring up these ideas and people laugh at me, but can you imagine a beautiful stateroom? You've got your Wi-Fi and you've got your computer and you take 5 days to get to your conference. Things have to slow down. Things have to centralize. We need to have old-fashioned medieval cities, centralized, compressed living, circled by farms. The food you produce around you is the food you eat. That is the model for how to survive. What is the next? The big danger is the next 2 centuries. The big danger is the next century, really, with this pulse in human population.
And what reaction have you gotten? A lot of snickers and a lot of eyes rolled to the ceilings when you talk about a lifestyle of the Middle Ages?
Well, they call me Cassandra, and I get this Chicken Little over and over and over. I tried to do an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they wrote back saying, well, we're not going to print this. And I said, why not? I said, well, it's not that we don't believe you. It's just that it's such a horrible fate that it's just not going to happen. Okay, why not? Well, it's just it can't because it's too terrible. So why scare people? Even if it's going to happen, it's too terrible. So it won't happen.
They actually said that to you?
Yeah, written. I mean, just said, nope, can't do this.
So if it's too terrible,
it makes me laugh.
If it's too terrible, it's not going to happen because it's too terrible.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what I get from most of this conversation.
And last question. If you were to estimate or take a guess as to the most likely scenario, we painted, of course, a worst-case scenario and temperatures keep on rising and so on and so forth. But if you were to then say what is the most likely scenario, what would you say?
I say the population peaks at 9 billion, goes back down to 7 and 6. I say that emissions go up to about 600, and then we bring it back down to the mid-400s.
And why do they go down again? Things don't go down for nothing.
Well, they go down because if we can reduce population, they certainly will go down. And if we can increase the efficiency of power plants, if we can bring in the solar, bring in all these possibilities, yes, they will go down. But I do think we're going to have a case where sea level, in my own estimation, sea level will certainly hit 5 or 6 feet above what it is now, and hopefully doesn't go any higher than that.
Okay, and maybe our properties will be underwater by then.
Well, if you have a view property now, it'll be a waterfront property. And if you have a waterfront property now, you could make it an underwater park.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, you've been listening to our special guest, Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology and Earth and Planetary Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.